coming to you direct from the heart of New York City all the way to wherever you are. You're listening to the VIP Jazz Wall Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. A question for you, and it continues to prevail today, is that where exactly do we stand against this so-called war against terror? And to help answer this, our guest is probably the world's only authority on counterterrorism. He's the world's leading expert on asymmetric warfare and provides advice to the U.S. Special Operations Command, the FBI's Counterterrorism Division, the Green Berets, the CIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the National Intelligence Council. He's just come out with a book called Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. I've had the privilege of reading this book, and it is a must-buy for you and your family. It changes everything you know about terror so far and replaces it with the reality and the truth. It's a pleasure to welcome back to the show Dr. Sebastian Gorka. Welcome back, Sebastian.
Wonderful to be back on your show, Vip. Thank you so much for having me.
So I read the book, and like I told you a few moments earlier, I really enjoyed it. I'm actually making my son read it. Fabulous read. It's a sort of a fact check and a reality check. Wouldn't you say?
I like that. Yeah, I think, unfortunately, the sad thing is, Vip, after 15 years, we do need a reality check because we're not winning this war.
Well, what made you write the book? Because of all of this?
You listed off all the places I have the honor of working at. So the real, you know, the war fighters, the FBI agents, the members of the intelligence community. Mm. And once you've given enough lectures, you get the same question. You always get, okay, so what would you do if you were the national security advisor? What would you tell the next president should be the plan? Mm. And, you know, I ran out of excuses and I decided, okay, well, we're in an election year. We will get a new commander-in-chief from either party. Mm-hmm. And what would I recommend as a way to defeat what I see as the new totalitarian threat of global jihadism?
Well, you know, I love the title. And you use the word defeating jihad. But jihad these days, I mean, I've had a few guests, Muslim guests on the show. And the word jihad, it's not, we don't seem to be just in a war of terror, but also a war of words. You know, my Muslim guests have said jihad is a struggle. Some people think jihad means a fight for freedom. So can you tell us what it really means?
Yes. So your friends are correct that jihad has had many different meanings over the centuries. It's evolved, it's been exploited by various caliphs, various emperors, various rebels to define the things they're doing. And one definition is a kind of internal struggle against temptation. But that's just a partial definition. In the Quran itself, there are many, many more instances of the uses of the word jihad to mean martial battle, so war, kinetic war. And the whole point of the book is to have the American reader understand that the 20th century saw a reconceptualization of this word, the modern definition of jihad, which comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood. It comes out of the dissolution of the Ottoman Empire, the last caliphate after World War One, and it's wedded to key strategic events of the 20th century, such as the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and the Iranian Revolution. All of these things combined have created the current most popular and deadly definition of jihad, which is a global movement, a holy war, to reestablish the caliphate, the empire, the theocracy of Islam for the glory of God. And that's how Al-Qaeda understands it, that's how ISIS understands it, and that's very, you know, unfortunately, how Farouk and Malik from San Bernardino understood it when they slaughtered those 14 government workers at that Christmas party recently in December.
So if I get this straight, effectively jihad, the word jihad today means a mission so-called of geographical expansion for religious coverage, i.e. converting the whole world to Islam.
Well, it's if you ask ISIS, if you read their magazines, their jihadi documents, it's either a conversion of those that are not Muslims or a subjugation. We've seen what happened to the Yazidis, the sex slaves in Nigeria for Boko Haram, or it's the death. It's the crushing or the subjugation or the conversion of those who are infidels.
And we, you know, I think the public sometimes, well, I get confused. It's more than just a war off terror. It's more than just a war against terror. What we are facing is possibly or probably an invasion.
It's not, yeah, it's very easy to just look at the physical aspects of this war. So when ancient statues are blown up, when the relics of Palmyra are destroyed in Syria by ISIS, when hostages are beheaded, when cities are invaded such as Mosul. But it's much, much more than that. It really has to do with culture, values, and identity. Look at one thing. So after the second Paris attacks, after we had Charlie Hebdo, and then we had the heinous attacks with the suicide bombers at the soccer stadium and elsewhere, one of the perpetrators was on the lam. He escaped from Paris, and for 4 months, he was the most wanted man in the world. And most people thought, well, this is going to be hard to find him, because look, ISIS is out there. They've captured swaths of territory in Syria and Iraq. He's bound to have gone to the Middle East, and he's hiding out in a war zone. Well, lo and behold, what do we find just before the recent Brussels attack? This man didn't leave Europe. He was hiding in plain sight. He was hiding in the capital, if you will, of the European Union in Brussels. And as a result, we have to understand that it's not just about the war in faraway places. It's about an invasion of values. It's the creation of enclaves. And it's about death on the streets of Western capitals or on office buildings in California.
You mentioned values. And in the book, you've actually almost changed the definition of Islam from a religion to a so-called revolutionary party. Why is that?
Well, I didn't do that. That's one of the key authors. That's one of the key jihadi strategists, if you will, of this new movement. It's Syed Qutb. It's where the story begins in Egypt after World War II. The Muslim Brotherhood's most influential thinker, he turned Islam, or he said Islam isn't just a faith. It's actually a political movement with a global mandate. So that's what the bad guys say it is. I wouldn't say that goes for all Muslims, because remember, there are some incredibly brave Muslims that are on our side. King Abdullah of Jordan, President Sisi of Egypt. Remember that horrendous image of the Jordanian fighter pilot burnt alive in a cage by ISIS. Well, what was his religion? He wasn't a Jew, he wasn't a Zoroastrian, he wasn't a Yazidi or a Christian. He was a Sunni Muslim. So there's many versions of Islam. The real sad thing and the troubling thing, Vip, is it's the fundamentalist, it's the violent, it's the ISIS version of Islam that seems to be in ascendance, and that's why it looks as if we are losing this war currently.
So you're saying we are losing this war, because I'm confused. You know, I was going to ask you, are we winning the war against terror? But you're comfortably saying we are losing it.
Okay, so in certain regards, when it comes to very tactical, low-level things, we are amazing. Look at the Abbottabad raid. The Abbottabad raid will be taught for decades to come as this incredible operation. We're deep into Pakistani territory. We lose a helicopter, and nevertheless, we execute the mission. Bin Laden's dead. We come home with a treasure trove of information. So that's superlative. But just because you have a tactical victory doesn't mean you have a strategic success. So there's this kind of strange dichotomy here. There's a schizophrenic reality that when it comes to the physical application of violence, we are the best. Nobody comes close to us. You give us the GPS coordinates of a bad guy, we will be able to neutralize him within a matter of hours. But when it comes to the psychological, to the ideological aspects of this war, the reason why a young man or a young woman would want to become a suicide bomber, we haven't even begun to fight that war because we deny the relevance of religion. And when you deny the relevance of religion, you're never going to understand or prevent things such as suicide attacks or the San Bernardino shooting.
I'm so glad you said the relevance of religion, because I wanted to discuss with you, you know, is this the greatest misunderstood war in history? And I'll tell you why. Our soldiers are patriots. Their soldiers are fanatics. You know, are our soldiers psychologically ready? Because we seem to be fighting the war over there, they're fighting the war over here, we're on the offensive over there, we're on the defensive over here. How can we hope to win?
Vip, I really have to give you credit. That is perhaps one of the most incisive questions I've had so far. The idea that this is the most misunderstood war in history, wow, that just may have to be the title of my next book. I wholeheartedly agree. I have a very controversial conclusion that I've drawn that I share with people. I think there's a very specific reason. It's not an accident that 22 vets are killing themselves every day. There's a very specific reason why we have an inordinate high amount of PTSD, of post-traumatic stress syndrome, occurring now amongst our veterans. And the reason is exactly what you're talking about, the misunderstood nature of this war. When your government doesn't know what it's doing, did we go to war to defeat Al-Qaeda or to build hospitals in Afghanistan? Did we go to war in revenge for 9/11 or to make sure that girls can go to school? That creates a level of confusion that's very difficult to deal with. And I just think about the 1950s. Our American forefathers, the grandfathers that went to war in World War II, they saw some horrific things, especially in the Pacific, in Iwo Jima. But they didn't come home, and we didn't see huge numbers of them, you know, kill themselves when they came home, commit suicide because they couldn't handle it, despite what they had seen. But why is that? Why is it happening now? Because in the 1940s, we knew and we had been told by our president that we are on the side of the angels. You may see some horrific things in Asia, in the death camps of Europe, but it's okay. The enemy is evil and you are good. Today, our war fighters do not have that clarity because our political leaders don't give it to them. We don't use words like enemy. We definitely don't use words like evil. So when they see some very tough things, it is very hard to digest them because we do not, as you have implied, we do not understand the stakes of the current conflict.
And I find, you know, politics today polluting the fight against terror. We keep sort of, like the media and the administration, keep battling over the use of words. You know, I find that very... How does changing terminology change the strategy?
Yeah, it's incredibly important. If you make the statement, as the deputy spokeswoman for the State Department did on national television, that America will be safe, there will be no more 9/11s, if jihadis have jobs. Do you remember that? Maria Harf said, terrorism is a consequence of unemployment and lack of education.
Yes.
Well, if you believe that, then we're never going to win this war because America can't provide full employment for everybody in the world. It's an utter misdiagnosis. Of course, the 19 hijackers weren't unemployed. Jihadi John, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the head of ISIS, these aren't people born in refugee camps in Palestine. These are well-to-do individuals with postgraduate degrees. It's an utter misdiagnosis of why the enemy wishes to kill us. And the analogy, I'm in Fort Bragg. I just gave this analogy to some young Special Forces officers here. Imagine if a patient goes to a clinic and he's got a fever of 102, and in fact he has lymphatic cancer, but the doctor says, you've got the flu. Take a couple of aspirins, go home and hydrate, and you'll be fine. That's the situation we're in. We have a complete misdiagnosis, and as a result, we will not cure the ill of jihadism, and we could lose this war.
Do we need to maybe subconsciously create a propaganda of truth within America, within our soldiers, And in a way, get them to really wake up and say, you know, because terror now, people have become numb to it to a certain extent. If you use the words like invasion, robbing of your religion, because ultimately that's what these guys are trying to do.
I think we have to do something. We have to understand that this is a war and we are a nation at war. We have to mobilize our people. Remember, this is a bipartisan problem. Do you remember after the September 11th attacks, one of the most famous things President Bush did? He went to the site of the attacks, but then he said to Americans in a press conference, you know, go out and shop. Yeah, go out shopping.
Right.
That's not what I want if from my commander-in-chief if we're at war. So we have to understand that it isn't about just getting back to normal.
Mm.
There is a group of people out there who will not be negotiated with. And the American people need to understand that. We cannot sit down at a fancy hotel in Switzerland, as we did with the Iranians or with others, and talk about some kind of ceasefire. If the enemy thinks you're an infidel who should be converted or killed, there is nothing to negotiate. Either you convert or you will be killed. This is the fundamental problem. Clausewitz was the master of strategy, and he said something most people forget. The first responsibility of the commander is to understand the nature of the war he is about to engage in. For 15 years, whether it is a conservative administration or a liberal one, we have misunderstood the nature of our enemy and the nature of this war.
And you're quite sure that our leaders have attempted to speak with the leaders of ISIS?
No, but not with the leaders of ISIS, but they've done this with the Taliban. We've seen this. We've seen this in Afghanistan, and I've seen it. The idea, it's redolent. It comes across in all the different statements made that we're not going to talk about ideology. Religion is irrelevant. It's about economic conditions. It's about education. It's about grievances. This is the favorite phrase of the administration. It's about grievances that can be resolved. Well, that wasn't true for Hitler, and it's not true for ISIS. What can you negotiate about with a totalitarian? And it is imperative to understand that our current enemy is a new type of totalitarian. We faced the Nazis. That was a race-based totalitarianism. We faced the Soviet Union and her allies for 45 years. That was a class-based totalitarianism. Now we have what I call a hybrid totalitarianism. It is a totalitarianism that is religiously informed, but it is a complete absolutist system where either you comply or you will be subjugated or you will be killed.
Interestingly enough, on reading your book, page 35, you said, our European allies do not have what it takes to fight this war. Why do you say that?
Because I look at the last 15 years, I look at defense spending, and I look at the classic guns or butter dilemma that, you know, nations have to choose, have to establish the balance between guns or butter.
Mm.
And if you look at it again and again and again, they don't take the defense of their nations seriously. And also, they are taking political decisions. I'm talking about the elites, not the population. They take political decisions that actually help the bad guys, that exacerbate the problem. When you allow large influxes of immigrants into your country in ways that advertise that multiculturalism is the norm, all cultures are equal, and there is therefore no requirement for the integration of other cultures into the nation state, you will create the kinds of things that we saw in Brussels, where we have enclaves where people can hide for 4 months despite being on the most wanted list of Europol. You will create systems in which the nation state itself fractures and will be exploited by those who wish to change that system. So the will to fight, just tell me, Vip, where are the Churchills, the Adenauers, the De Gaulles, or the Thatchers? They do not exist. I mean, I'm sorry, Cameron is not even a pale shadow of the little pinky finger of a Winston Churchill or a Margaret Thatcher. That's what I mean by lacking the will to win.
No, they've been slapped on the face so many times, they're now being slapped on the back of the head.
Yes.
It literally is. It feels like that. But after the incidents in Brussels and Paris, do you sense a change in perspective?
I see a kind of instantaneous knee-jerk reaction. Look what happened in Paris. The EU created this borderless zone with the Maastricht Treaty, freedom of travel inside Europe, total freedom. Well, what does France do? President Hollande says, sorry, we are reinstigating our borders. We are going to reestablish identity checks. This project Europe seems to have failed us. Same kind of thing after Brussels. What do we have? We have the deployment of the military on the streets. We have a state of high alert maintained for weeks on end. But sooner or later, it's going to snap back because you have the same politicians in control. The practitioners, the people on the street, the members of the intelligence community, the national security professionals, they understand the threat. There is no question to them that the global jihadi movement has penetrated the continent and is a dire threat to that community. But it's their bosses, it's the political masters who still perpetuate this idealism of the federative European Union and push things that facilitate terrorism. That's where we have the disconnect. That's where we have the cognitive dissonance, if you will, of the European continent.
Well, then, based on that and what was in the book, the revelation that I got was that America is the only nation positioned to defeat jihad.
Bingo. Absolutely right. Yes.
What are the top three things we have that we can actually defeat jihad?
Well, if you want to take it seriously, if the next commander-in-chief wants to actually approach this as a totalitarian threat, there are just a couple of things that have to be done. Number one, and it echoes upon what we've already discussed, we have to have a leader who is prepared to talk truthfully about the threat. We have to get politics out of the threat assessment, out of the intelligence cycle. We have to say that the enemy is religiously motivated, and the enemy is evil. The same way we did with the Third Reich, with Hitler, the same way we did, remember Reagan's evil empire speech. You can't say this is about unemployment and lack of education. It is about evil. When you go on a TV screen and take 7 minutes to decapitate another human person's head, that's evil. So let's be honest about the nature of the threat. Second, we have to understand that the face of this war must be our Muslim allies. It's not going to be white-skinned or brown-skinned American Christians in the Middle East who are going to win this war. It has to be the Jordanians. It has to be the UAE, the Egyptians that close with and crush ISIS. But that will never happen. If you're familiar with the region, that will never happen unless those actors are Sunni allies, trust us and believe we support them. Right now, and I'm talking from experience, the key personnel of that region, the leaders, do not trust the White House, not after the last 14 years. We went there, we broke all the china in the shop, and we left and we didn't pay any bills. We are not trusted, and I don't blame them. And lastly, this goes to what you mentioned earlier, the subconscious kind of propaganda aspect. We have to fight this war on the level of ideas. Killing terrorists is great, but it's not enough. That's just whack-a-mole. We have to delegitimize their ideology the same way we did during the Cold War. During the Cold War, the CIA created and owned whole publishing houses in Europe covertly. Today, we do nothing to assist the very brave Muslim reformers who are pushing back day in, day out on the internet against the jihadists. We don't help them because they're talking about religious things. But these people, they will help us win this war, and we have to have a gargantuan covert propaganda attempt to take down the ideology of the jihadists.
Only something the new commander-in-chief can do, right?
Yes.
But interestingly enough, have you noticed that there really haven't been any terror attacks in places like Dubai, Abu Dhabi? is there some sort of a secret relationship going on there? Because if you think about it, it's Muslim soil, and you can get alcohol there. You have nightclubs there. It's just basically an Arabic version of the West.
Yeah, it's a very interesting observation. So if you want to play bad guys, if you want to do what they call red teaming in the military, so try and think like the bad guy, there's a hierarchy of targets. So, you know, maybe everybody outside of your threat group is an infidel, but that doesn't mean you're going to hit everybody at the same time. So there's a priority. And the whiskey-drinking Arabs of the Gulf, they're an enemy, but they're not the priority. And right now, for ISIS, for example, the 5-meter target, the proximate target, is to demonstrate that they can actually govern a caliphate. They have more than 6 million souls on the territory of the new Islamic State. They have to prove that they can run this quasi-empire. So that's the first thing. Then they have the 20-meter target, and that, in my opinion, is the regimes, the governments of Saudi Arabia and Jordan. The ISIS leaders have to demonstrate that these aren't truly Islamic states, that the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan is a puppet of the West and has to be destroyed. So that's the secondary target. And of course, if you are creating a caliphate, what is it essential for you to have? Sooner or later, you must take control of Mecca and Medina. Not only are the Saudi kings and princes also seen as apostates, as puppets of the West, but the symbolic significance of capturing the land where Muhammad established the religion cannot be overestimated. So, you know, the UAE and other places, yeah, that's a problem. There are issues there, but there are priorities in terms of who we're going to get next.
Well, let's come back to the U.S. and on U.S. soil with the presidential election. Who do you think, out of the circus of clowns that we have at the moment, is most suited to handle this war?
Well, unfortunately, both of the Democrat candidates are just perpetuating myths that will get us into more trouble and endanger more Americans. So we have Secretary Clinton, who's stated on the record that it is not Islamic extremism. I will not use that phrase. She's perpetuating the myth that it's lack of education and economics. So she's basically a third term of the Obama administration, so there's no hope there. And then Senator Sanders is even worse. This is a man who said that terrorism is caused by global warming or climate change. So, I mean,
it is kind of hot in Syria and Iraq.
Yeah, it is hot, but it's been hot there for a few millennia. So, you know, it's like a bad SNL skit. So the weather made me decapitate you. I'm sorry. So, you know, no, the Democrats have ruled themselves out when it comes to credibility and national security. If you look at the Republican, the two, you know, the real people who have a chance, the real estate mogul from New York is a broken record. He's like a one-trick pony. He likes to talk about waterboarding or what more we're going to do on top of waterboarding. And there's no detail there. There's no level of it. He says, we're going to crush ISIS and it's going to be awesome. Yeah, you need a little bit more than that if you're going to be the president of the most powerful nation in the world. So there's a huge vacuum of details when it comes to Donald Trump.
But, you know, in a way, is he actually being smarter than us? Because if he's going to give detail on information he doesn't fully have, because he hasn't reached the White House yet.
Right.
You know, it's sometimes very difficult to lay claim to something. You remember that phrase that Senior Bush said, no new taxes.
Yeah, right.
And then when he came in, he uncovered a whole different set of issues that actually made him raise taxes.
Yeah, of course, when you are at war, you don't give away the crown jewels. So this was, you know, you don't do what Bill Clinton did in Yugoslavia, and he said openly, "We are never going to use ground troops. You just don't do that." But I really, you know, I would bet a large sum of money if I were a betting man that this isn't Trump being smart. I don't think he has the things he is hiding. There's nothing there. There's no there. Because if you look at answers to other questions, like the fact he didn't know what the nuclear triad was and all the other stumbles he's made, it would be a very charitable interpretation to say that he's not giving us the details because he has them but wants to keep them secret.
So that leaves us with Cruz and Kasich.
Yes, Kasich again is it's just, you know, there's rhetoric and bluster there, but there's a lack of meat on the bone, and we're left with Senator Cruz. Now I have to recuse myself there to a certain extent because it's now official. My wife is actually one of the national security advisors for her campaign. But, you know, there's been some good things said, some hard things said. But then again, there's been a few flip-flops. He said, we're not going to deploy troops into the region. Later, he changed his mind on that and said, maybe troops are required. Mm. But if there's anybody who has some consistency, who has some substance to their plan, I would have to say it is actually Senator Cruz.
I was hoping you'd say Trump, for the simple reason Trump doesn't like to lose.
Well, look, it would be refreshing. It would be very refreshing if we had a commander-in-chief who actually doesn't think winning is a dirty word. We don't use words like victory very much anymore, let alone, you know, enemy or good and evil. So yeah, if we could have a little bit of that winning attitude in all of our candidates who understand this is a war and wars are either won or lost, that would be a distinct change from the last few years.
On page 120 in your book, you say all Muslims have been told that the final holy war will take place in al-Sham, and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi feeds people with that.
Yes.
What if we were to go and destroy the place? Wouldn't that demoralize ISIS and shake the very foundation they used to exist?
Well, you're now talking about the eschatological narrative that is being very deftly exploited by ISIS. So ISIS is saying that we are on the territory of this area called al-Sham, which as part of the religion of Islam is designated as the site of the last jihad, the last holy war before Judgment Day. So they've brought a certain reality, a tangible quality to the last war, the end times jihad. And yeah, I've heard this several times that, you know, why don't we just give them what they want? They think this is the end times. Well, let's deploy the 82nd Airborne and all the Marines and just, you know, turn Dabiq or turn Raqqa into a parking lot. Number one, after the last 15 years, I don't care who you are. You can be President Trump. You can be Hillary Clinton. That is not happening. The U.S. taxpayer simply will not countenance a full-scale, conventional-sized deployment of our military into the region. So there's a political stumbling block. Secondly, we have to be careful. You don't make yourself a hostage to the propaganda of the enemy. But if the enemy says, you know, you will know it is the end times when the infidel invades, and then we invade. What have we done in terms of satisfying and proving their propaganda to be true? It will be not a case of, you know, 20,000 jihadis recruited in a year by ISIS. Mm. It will be 20,000 jihadis recruited in a week because they're going to say, look, we told you so, here they come, you better get here now. So we will be assisting in their capacity to recruit. That doesn't mean we don't go to war with them, but it returns us to my second recommendation. You want Muslims, our Muslim allies, to be the face of this war, and that's why in Defeating Jihad, I talk about the importance of groups like of nations such as Jordan and Egypt. We have to help them go to war, but we shouldn't be the face of the war.
You see, the leadership of ISIS could turn that around and say, look, all these misguided brothers are going to the West, so now we need more recruits. to preserve what we have.
They could do that, but when it gets to a certain scale, so allegedly the Obama administration has brought together an alliance of more than 60 nations. That's really a Potemkin fabrication. I've been to CENTCOM, I've been to the Middle East, and you know there's hardly any Arab nations involved in a very serious, tangible way. But if there were, if you had multiple Arab nations deploying their Muslim fighters, sooner or later, the fence sitter or the undecided individual is going to say, hang on, there's 70,000 guys on one side who say they're the real Muslims, and then we've got, you know, nations that total 50, 60, 100 million Muslims against them on the other side. I think the laws of probability probably mean that I'm going to go with the Egyptians or the Jordanians. So there's a point at which scale outweighs argument. There's a certain, you know, a certain weight that scale has all by itself.
But that's, you know, that's logic driven by the Western mindset. You know what I mean? But the average Egyptian soldier on the ground, if he's made to feel guilty that he's fighting his Muslim brother on ISIS. And these guys exist for religion.
Yeah, you're a real troublemaker. You know the region far too well. Yeah, one of the first sins, and I say this myself, is one of the first sins we commit in when we analyze these issues is we mirror image. We expect, you know, the local system to reflect the kinds of things we see back home. And you're right, that's not the case. This isn't, you know, Montana, and this isn't, you know, Cambridge, Mass. This is a very different situation. Nevertheless, let's take the Egyptian case. I have met General Sisi when he was a general. This is a devoutly Muslim individual, but he is very clear, and he's clear with his Egyptian voters and with his soldiers, that he is a Muslim, yes, but that is secondary to him being an Egyptian first. And he is very clear that I am a Muslim, but the Islam of the ISIS fighters is not the Islam I approve of. So if you want to be an upstanding member of the Egyptian society, you will be on the side of America, you will be on the side of Jordan or whoever else it is, and I am your president, and I'm sorry, you elected me, so what I say goes. It's not a very, you know, State Department relevant and approved message, but it does work for the region. You are the devout head of the most populous Arab nation in the world, that gives you a certain credibility.
And the other thing, you know, I think a week or two ago, I think we managed to get the one of the important guys in ISIS. We killed him.
The number two, the finance guy, yes.
Well, here's the question. You know, we're out to kill their leaders, but isn't that a problem? Because it's more dangerous to have a misguided lone wolf than it is to have a strategic leader. I mean, we can gauge how a leader thinks. Because, like you said, these guys are educated. So we can almost, we're better able to second guess their next move. But it's very difficult to get into the mind of a single lunatic.
Well, look, careful. I caution people using the word crazy or lunatic. And we can understand the bad guys if we understand their culture, and I think, you know, you're in a position, I'm in a position, because we're familiar with their texts, but the fact is most people don't. They do mirror image. When it comes to the unpredictability of the independent actor, I would just request one thing. I tell people, you need to jettison the construct of lone wolf. There is no such thing as a lone wolf. The fact is, lone wolf is a phrase invented to make you stupid. It's invented to make you disconnect the dots. Whether it's a San Bernardino shooter, whether it's that man in his galabia shooting that police officer in Philadelphia, whether it's, you know, the Boston bombers, they're all connected. They're not lone actors. And the connective tissue between all of them is, of course, the ideology of global jihad. They're not crazy. They're not unpredictable, they've all read the same books. They've read Qutb, Malik. These are the authors I detail in defeating jihad, the key strategists of the jihadi movement. So even if they're one-off, two-off individuals, there is a logic to their action, which is the shared logic of the leaders of ISIS or even Al-Qaeda.
And in your book, Defeating Jihad, you also talk about protecting America by ourselves. It was very interesting. Page 138, you suggested we apply for a gun permit to protect ourselves. And on page 150, you suggest we should also own a copy of the Quran. You didn't mention in any page that we should also own a copy of Defeating Jihad, the Winnable War.
That would be a bit self-serving.
Yes. So the gun and the Quran.
Yeah, look, there are reasons. So number one, and I've said this on national television, the fact is that there's so much spurious and totally fallacious information out there about what is and is not Islam. And I just tell my readers, look, don't take anybody's word for it. Why don't you judge for yourself? Buy the primary source document, the Quran, and read it. How would you be able to have an opinion of Christianity if you didn't know what the Bible said? So that's just common sense. And I say to everybody I meet, after 9/11, every American should have a Bible, should have a Quran. Whether you're an atheist, whether you're a Christian, a Jew, or a Muslim, you should have one just so that you understand what it actually says. Second, when it comes to my recommendation, we have to be honest. The front line of this war isn't necessarily in Baghdad. It isn't necessarily in Tikrit or Mosul. The front line of this war is you. It's the listener to this show. It's the reader of my book. It's the individuals at that Christmas party in San Bernardino. The war isn't something happening in the Middle East or in Africa or in faraway lands. It's happening here. In America, we have had 98 ISIS supporters arrested or killed on the U.S. territory since the declaration of the Islamic State. That's almost 100 people here in America. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when they do the next attack. And if you have the mental fortitude to carry a gun, if you can be licensed to do so, and if you have the training requisite to do that, then you should consider being able to defend yourself and your loved ones.
Well, you know, you should have a downloadable version of the Quran on your website.
That's a very good idea, and I'll try and find one in the public domain. That's a superb question.
Yeah, that would help.
Yeah, thank you.
Now, if people are protecting themselves and they're walking around with guns and things like that, that's one step of protecting ourselves. Another way of protecting is, should we also be very concerned and start paying more attention to what's happening in the mosques, how the American Muslims are reacting to what's going on with these terrorist events?
Right. So this is where we get onto, you know, territory that has got Senator Cruz and others into trouble. So let's just look at the facts. Whether it's Richard Reid, the shoe bomber, right after 9/11, or whether it's the Brussels attackers or others, there is a pattern that we see, and it is the exploitation and the identification of radical mosques and the exploitation of the imams in those mosques. If you're looking for Islamic terrorists, how much sense does it make to look for them in an ashram or in an Episcopal service? Not a lot of sense. So, you know, you look for the Cosa Nostra and the Italian mafia in Little Italy. You don't look for them in the Somali district of Minnesota. So let's just get a little bit of common sense onto the table. And let's look at the history of the last 15 years. One of the most effective post-9/11 initiatives was what happened to the NYPD. after 9/11, the New York mayor, the police department said they'd basically been betrayed by federal intelligence. They hadn't been protected and served adequately. So what did they do? They took the NYPD from being a police department and turning it into one of the most effective counterterrorism intelligence services in the world. How did they become so good at it? Because they had people who spoke the languages, who came from the region, who were turned into human intelligence professionals and inserted into those districts, into those areas where the bad guys are. If you want to catch a bad guy before he straps on a suicide vest, you have to go to where he is. And he's far more likely to be eating a halal Sikh kebab than he's in a Pakistani restaurant than he is going to be eating a kosher dinner in a Jewish restaurant. So let's just get the political correctness under control and start to do national security the way it should be done.
You know, that leads me to wonder. I've had a few Muslim guests on the show, and I've always told them, I said, why do I not see or hear the Muslim community working with us? And I'm sure, you know, there are a few. They always mention one or two names. But that's one or two out of hundreds of thousands of Muslims. So I'm not going to give credit to the exception. I'm talking about the majority.
Yeah, this is a huge issue. And, of course, there are. There are some very brave people. There's Zudi Jasser. There's some people in the region. To understand this is a much deeper question, but a lot of it has to do with one of the most important sins in Islam, and that is fitna. Fitna is giving the impression of discord inside the Muslim community. And this has a huge pressure on Islamic society because it stunts or suppresses criticism of other Muslims. You may think another Muslim is doing something completely wrong, if he's a jihadi or anything else, but you publicly standing up and criticizing them gives the impression of discord in the community and weakens its perception globally.
And that is why Egypt and Jordan would never publicly come out and fight a war.
Well, I'm not so sure about that because they're not theocracies, or at least Egypt isn't. And, President Sisi has actually said on New Year's Day 2 years ago in the Al-Azhar, in the most important Sunni institution in the world, he said very clearly, he said, look, this is a religious war, not a war between Christians and Hindus and Muslims, but a war between Muslims. It's a war inside Islam, and we have to have a religious revolution inside Islam to defeat the jihadis, and the West can have a role in helping him. So it can be done, but only if you understand the importance of how the religion is being used by the jihadis.
Now, your book, Defeating Jihad, The Winnable War. Let's focus on the winnable war. What does winning look like? How do we know we've won?
Yeah, winning looks like one very simple thing. So today, it is the black flag of jihad that is too popular, too sexy. We have to turn that around. We have to make the brand, if you will. This is like, you know, the Coca-Cola of soft drinks. That's what ISIS is today. In the jihadi world, they have become the brand leader. We have to destroy that brand. We have to delegitimize it. We have to have enough of our allies who are Muslims say, that's not my Islam. That's not going to be perpetuated on my watch. Mm-hmm. We have to, the same way we did with communism, when we said, look, really, you're about peace, you're about prosperity. How's that eight-hour-long bread line doing for your prosperity? We have to hit them where it hurts and illuminate their lives for what they are with the help of those who are most at danger. Remember, they want to kill us, Vip, but first they want to kill the Muslims who disagree with them. Those are the people who have most to lose, and we have to help them.
Now, when's the book coming out?
So the book comes out on the 11th. So it's out on the 11th. You can order it already.
11th of April, right?
April. It's already available on Amazon. And you can get all the details at my website, which is The Gorka Briefing. So it's www.thegorka.com.
Thank you, Sebastian.
Thank you, Vip. It's been wonderful.
It's always a terror to talk to you because you give everything such a reality check. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for listening. Your comments and your follow are so very welcome on my Twitter account at VipJazzWorld and my Facebook page. Just type in VipJazzWorld Report. A special shout out of thanks to my wonderful team, William Sanchez and Rick Buser. I'll be back next Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern. And until then, I wish you a wonderful evening tonight with your loved ones. And until next Sunday, have a productive and a very happy week ahead.